following program is brought to you in living color on
DailyGazette.com or wherever you get your podcast.
The Daily Gazette Company presents the Parting Shots Podcast. Now, here's your host, Daily Gazette sports editor, Ken Schott.
Thank you, Scott Giese, and welcome to the Parting Shots Podcast. Available wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe today. Thanks for joining me from the Parting Shots Podcast Studio in Schenectady, New York. We have another great show for you. We're going to talk with former RPI men's head hockey coach Dave Smith. He's now in charge of the Rapid City Rush, head coach and general manager of that ECHL team. We don't say East Coast Hockey League because it really doesn't stand. Even though it says ECHL, it doesn't stand for East Coast Hockey League anymore. It's been that way for a long time because this league is spread about over the North America, so from East Coast to West Coast. So we'll talk to Dave about his new job, and we'll talk about what happened at RPI. He was relieved of his duties a couple of days after the Engineers lost to Harvard in the ECAC Hockey Tournament first round game. So Dave Smith will join us on that. And then after that, Mike McAdam, our Gazette horse racing writer, will talk about the start of the unofficial start of the Saratoga horse racing season, because the July 4th festival, which is normally down at Belmont or Aqueduct, it was moved off from Aqueduct. And of course, we know Belmont's still under reconstruction. So we're going to have 4 days of extra horse racing starting Thursday at Saratoga Racecourse. Mike will talk about that. And we really will get into the passing of trainer D. Wayne Lucas at the age of 89 on Saturday. Mike has a lot of great things to say about D. Wayne Lucas. So please tune in for that. So coming up, Dave Smith, we're going to talk hockey, both pro hockey and RPI hockey. You're listening to the Parting Shots Podcast.
Hi, I'm Stan.
And I'm Shen.
And each week we bring you the Stan and Shen Show. And each week we talk about fun things through our travels throughout the capital region. We touch on food, we touch on news, try to touch heavily on good news. And Shen's always available with hot takes.
Yeah, so if you could follow along and listen to us every week on DailyGazette.com or on all major streaming platforms, we'd love to have you join us.
Hi, this is Craig Conroy, Calgary Flames general manager, Clarkson hockey legend, and New York State Hockey Hall of Famer. You're listening to the Parting Shots podcast with Daily Gazette sports editor Ken Schott.
Welcome back to the podcast. My next guest was head coach at RPI Hockey for 8 seasons, and now he has a new job. He's going to be taking over the Rapid City Rush in the ECHL. Don't call it the East Coast Hockey League because that's not what it's called anymore. Let's welcome Dave Smith to the podcast. Dave, how are things going?
Going very well, Ken. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for coming on. We haven't really chatted since your dismissal at RPI. We'll get into that a little bit. But first of all, how excited are you for this new challenge out in Rapid City, South Dakota?
Yeah. I mean, it's, as we gain years and experience, you realize everything is another chapter, a different part of your own story. And this is the next chapter that we're excited, very excited about. My wife Susan and I will head out to South Dakota.
How did this come about?
Well, I think, that question gets asked a lot, and I don't know if it's a straight line. It's not I did this or somebody else did that. I think it's, years of connecting through the recruiting business, the pro side of things with it, your friends, agents, and then all of a sudden conversations come together, and it's one phone call from the Rapid City organization, and it feels good, and you have another one, and then by the end there's a job offer and a new partnership formed.
In a way, Dave, the ECHL is sort of like the AA in minor hockey league. Of course, you have the AHL, which is the AAA. I mean, being a general manager coach, it's sort of like being a college coach, because I know some you're associated with the Calgary Flames there, and they'll provide some players, but you had to go out and basically recruit players to join you. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, you've got to, our job, myself and the staff, assistant coach Peter Dricos, but also the team personnel. We're there to recruit and build a team, and as a general manager, that's the hat that I wear you know, all summer, but also a little bit during the season. So we go out and try to, you know, sell what the environment is in the locker room, what the environment is in the city, and how first class our organization is and how they treat players. And in this case in Rapid City, it's been really easy because the people that I've talked to that were there before and there currently as the players that are protected, they love it there. They love it. And I didn't know too much about it, but we've sent a few players over the years to Rapid City and they all said good things. So yeah, we've got a lot of hats to wear in the ECHL as GM and coach.
Well, I know one player that has been splitting time between Rapid City and the Calgary Wranglers in the AHL is a former Union goaltender, Connor Murphy, who has always seemed to be a thorn in your side, especially in the Mayor's Cup. Have you had a chance to talk to Connor?
I haven't talked to Connor yet. I know that I'm not sure if he was on a straight AHL or an NHL deal. I'm not sure, but those guys, you know, sort of the timeline filters down for them that if either the NHL or the American League team sign him and the ECHL is in, you know, his sights, then that's when we'll start to get a little bit more involved. But I have not talked to Connor yet, but I do know he was there.
Yeah. Did you think about maybe taking some time off after RPI, just maybe just, you know, take a breather maybe for a year or so? Or was it your goal to get back into coaching somewhere, either the pro or the college level?
You know, things happen so fast in terms of, you know, Friday night we're playing at Harvard and, you know, you put together a game plan and a belief and a mindset that you're going to win, and all of a sudden it's over and you come back and then, you know, changes are made. Really, the only plans I had was to, you know, spend time with family and to pay attention to my own thoughts and feelings and the feelings and thoughts of my wife and my two daughters, our two daughters. And, I woke up the next morning, it would have been a Tuesday morning, and my immediate feeling was, you know what, I want to keep doing something. I want to do something now. I don't really want to take a break. But I said, you know, I went and spent a week with one daughter and down south and another daughter farther down south. And then I spent some time with just my wife. And those are different experiences where, you know, your children don't really know how to treat their parent that, you know, has just been let go from a job that they love. And, you know, so, but through all of that, I realized that, I didn't want to take any time. I wanted to work and I want to stay active. And I love the business of hockey. And while it can be, you know, cruel and unusual, I wanted to stay in it.
What was it like that Monday when RPI Athletic Director Dr. Chrissy Bowers informed you that you were no longer the head coach?
I'm not sure, Ken, really how to put those things into words. I mean, I know that, you know, when things happen, and lots of things happen at RPI, and it really goes back to, you know, everybody has a story to tell, and, you know, our story might be different than other people's, but how RPI hockey and the institution came out of COVID was still a part of the story on that Monday, the last Monday. And then, you know, again, a new president, a new athletic director, and as things change, things continue to change. So how did I feel? Again, disappointed for sure, because, you know, you put, you know, not only myself, but Chuck Weber, Matthias Lang, Carlos Ernest, we put everything into it. Liam Sproul, you put everything into it trying to get it to go. And you know that, you know, there's reasons you are where you are, and some of them are in your control and some of them are out of them. But definitely a unique and different feeling that obviously by my words, it's hard to describe.
I mean, you have, as I said, 8 seasons there at RPI. What do you cherish the most and what do you regret the most?
Well, I don't live in a world of regrets. I'll start with that one, because every decision is pretty much thought out, right? You set a plan, you set a course of action. And much like we would tell our team, and you say it all the time, it's not a about anything other than, you know, win and reflect or learn and grow. And I learned a lot. I grew a lot, made some terrific friends and had some experiences, both positive and negative, but it helped me, you know, be a better father, be a better husband, be a better coach. So I don't know that anything really gets classified into one thing other than experiences and memories and relationships. And, you know, we learn and we grow.
You mentioned COVID. I mean, let's go back to like the 2019-20 season. And I had been 2 years back here since as associate sports editor after I had been laid off in 2017. Mike McAdam, who, by the way, says hello, he was covering Union at the time, and I was off on a Sunday sitting on my couch watching TV when the email came in about the press conference that RPI was having that announcing that there won't be any fans for the ECAC Hockey Tournament quarterfinal game against series against Harvard. And I know after I wrote the story, a lot of people were complaining, well, why? And then what happened a few days later when the Ivy League said, we're not playing anymore, we're done for the sports season with the COVID. And basically after that, they tried to get Colgate in as a substitute opponent, but then ECAC Hockey shut things down. And I felt at that time, your team was playing at that time, I think you guys had a legitimate chance at winning the ECAC Hockey Tournament. I mean, how difficult was that, knowing that team was playing so well going into the tournament? You had a first-round bye, obviously. How devastating was that to not be able to, go fulfill that goal?
Well, it's devastating and challenging and a lot of adversity, but maybe not in the moment, right? Not at that moment. At that moment, I think we were all as a world, as America was trying to, and Canada was trying to figure out what the heck was going on. And I think I remember there was legit fear for so many different things that we look back on it now as a different memory. On the hockey side of things alone, I was really proud of what we did. We had made some real tough decisions, on the ice, off the ice, and the blueprint worked. Like I know the blueprint worked, and that was validation because we had we were on a roll. We had a lot of momentum. We had a lot of pride and special feelings around that group that, we're coming together at the right time. And I had been a part of it on teams at Canisius. You know, I think one year we went undefeated in 17 games. And, another year we, got on a run and went to the NCAA tournament. And when you get that in the college environment, it is something special. And we had created a lot of that. And it's hard to describe, because you can't measure and say, well, 7 out of 10, 80% chance, anything like that. But, man, we were good. We had a really good team. And to have so much change literally in 1 week from, as you described it, exactly right. We beat Dartmouth on the road. We beat Harvard on the road, beat Dartmouth on the road. We clinched fourth. And then over such a short period of time, it's all taken away, not just from us, but from many, many, many people in sports teams. And then to know now, look back and see the impact it had on so many different businesses and people. And, we're talking about the RPI hockey team, and I still don't think the RPI hockey program has recovered from those days.
Yeah, because in 2020-21, the school followed the lead of the Ivies, decided not to play. Of course, Union did the same thing. So basically, you're down to four ECAC hockey teams in that 2020-21 season. And then they come back in 21-22, but with the stipulation that I believe it was Dr. Shirley Jackson who maybe ordered this. I don't know, order might be a strong word, but the only fans allowed at the at all RPI sporting events were on campus. Students, faculty, and staff, nobody from the outside. I was kind of surprised the media was allowed to cover games at the hockey, but how much did that year really affect the program? Because it seemed like, you know, NHL scouts weren't allowed to come, and it seemed like players, you know, entered the transfer portal after that season. A lot of players entered the portal.
Well, the narrative around hockey, and I look at what we did is in recruiting. We were recruiting hockey players that could do the schoolwork, not just students who could play hockey. And the court of public opinion really devastated the RPI hockey narrative. And that's when, you know, players left, and the guys that wanted to play hockey would just, you know, and coaches and agents and scouts would say, well, how you're recruiting hockey players, you don't go there because hockey's not important. Look at the decisions that they've made. And, you know, that was felt immediately with the transfer, but it was also felt, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 years down the line when we were putting our efforts into just convincing people that RPI was a place that good hockey players could go. And, you know, it was very much a challenge. And I think it still remains that, you know, how important is hockey, but, you know, you know it's important in the moment, and you know you can feel things happening, and you dig in and do the best we can.
How well do you know Eric Lang, and how do you think he'll do?
I wish him the best. Honestly, I Eric and I have been friends for a long time. There's some family connections between his wife and my daughter, and you know, I don't wish ill will on anybody, but I do. You know, I'll follow it from the outside and wish them all the best.
What will you miss about RPI and college coaching in particular?
Well, there's a passionate fan base, right? And I think they were hurt by some of the COVID decisions as well. And, you know, the first thing that I think about is, you know, my wife also worked at RPI, and she loved the environment and, you know, the connections that you make with people around the community, the students, you know, again, I think of my wife and I as a team, and that branched out across different sports, different businesses, different friendship groups. And, you know, that's what you miss right away.
How much are you looking forward to getting going and with this new job? I mean, the way the schedule is in that league, you're not going to come east, unfortunately. It'll be out in the Midwest. A lot of travel, I would imagine, out in Rapid City.
Yeah, I mean, it's a first class operation. We fly everywhere, no bus trips. We fly everywhere, and a lot of work and planning and teamwork goes into each of those trips, and that's already started, you know. So I think I've been on the job as of, you know, the tape and the recording of this podcast. I've been on the job, you know, approaching 2 weeks, maybe. I can't remember. It's just before, just over, just under 2 weeks. But, you know, every day we're doing something, just trying to build our team.
Well, I was reading the press release on the team's website. They haven't had the press conference introduced you yet. Not till Wednesday. No, not till next Wednesday.
Yeah, there's some simplicity in pro hockey that, like I said, everything is around the hockey program. And, you know, I've done a number of interviews with the media there, and been able to connect with the players, and also been able to, you know, find some players. So, you know, the timing of the press conference is, I think it's the 7th, or at least next week. So that'll be, you know, get some things lined up in advance to meet the sponsors, to meet the people that are key around the city, as well as we've already got some water under the bridge with some of the players.
Well, Dave, I appreciate all you've done. I know, you know, fortunately, the way our business and the newspaper business is, we love to be able to go cover RPI, but you just don't have the bodies anymore, unfortunately. But you've always been nice with me and cooperative, whether I needed some information or anything. I appreciate what you've done, and I wish you all the best out in Rapid City.
Well, thanks, Ken, and, you know, give Mike a hello back. And you know, there's a lot of good people that are passionate about what you do, and it makes a difference. And, you know, like I said, we learn and grow from each experience. And, you know, we'll, even though it's painful how some of the chapters end, the next chapter starts with excitement. And my wife, Susan, and I are looking forward to that.
Well, good luck out there, and maybe bring home a Kelly Cup championship.
That'd be great. Yeah. That's what we're trying to do.
All right. Dave, appreciate a few minutes. Thanks again.
Thanks, Dan.
All right, that's Dave Smith. Coming up, we're going to talk Saratoga horse racing with Mike McAdam. Mark Gazette Horse Racing Expert. You're listening to the Parting Shots Podcast.
If you really want to know what's going on in your community, you have to read the Daily Gazette. We don't take a side. We're right down the middle, and we're going to get to the truth. Our reporters and photographers are out in the field bringing you updates every minute with trust, accuracy, and integrity. From the first page to the last page, independent, probing journalism. We're finding out what's going on in the community where nobody else is covering. It's who we are. It's what we do.
What's up, everybody? This is Freddie Coleman from ESPN Radio's Freddie and Harry Show, 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. Eastern Time, Monday through Friday. You're listening to the Parting Shots Podcast with my man, Ken Schott, the Daily Gazette sports editor.
Welcome back to the podcast, and it's time for horse racing again at Saratoga. Not the official start of the regular meet, but we have the July 4th Festival getting underway on Thursday at the track, and our man Mike McAdam at the track with Mac will be there, of course, all 4 days. And Mike, how much are you looking forward to this? We'll get into the logistics of why it's up here, but it seems like some more bonus horse racing for you.
9 extra days of racing compared to the usual 40 between the 5 days of the Belmont Racing Festival and then the 4 days, coming up with the 4th of July. It's like I took vacation last week for a reason, sort of like the calm before the two storms, between the storms instead of in the middle of the storm. So we're cranking it up again. I was at the barns this morning, Tuesday and Sunday as well, and it's still kind of a ghost town up there a little bit. They're still making their way up from downstate, but by the end of this week, it's going to be a week early on the usual traditional start of the Saratoga meet, but it'll be quite the bustling place come Thursday when they start the 4th of July festival.
And speaking of weather and all storms, it's kind of before the storm, as we're taping this here on Tuesday afternoon, it is pouring outside our Parting Shots podcast studio here at the Daily Gazette offices. So it's kind of a crazy day with the weather. But
And the funny thing is, I checked the forecast for the rest of the week, and it was only supposed to rain this morning, and it didn't. And then now it is. So I'll have to go back and revisit that to see if anything else is shifting. But, I mean, through Saturday, I think it was looking like 80s and sunny, but you never know at Saratoga. It could change in a heartbeat.
Well, the meteorologists have all these tools, and they somehow still manage to get the weather forecast wrong.
My favorite is street-level radar. I got your street-level radar. It's called my two eyes that work. I love that one.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing the technology they have, and like I said, they still get it wrong. I think they were more accurate back in the 70s when they didn't have the all that technology, but we digress. But let's get talking what we're here for, horse racing. And unfortunately, on some sad news on the eve of the July 4th festival at Saratoga, Thoroughbred Racing lost a legend on Saturday when Hall of Fame trainer D. Wayne Lucas died at the age of 89, surrounded by family at his home in Louisville, Kentucky. Mike, can you summarize his impact on the sport and what racing will miss now that he's gone?
What's the time limit on this podcast?
There is no time limit.
Even a summary is going to take a little bit.
Go ahead.
Just to cover all the accomplishments that D. Wayne Lucas did over decades and decades. And just for background purposes, it wasn't like a big surprise, but everything did sort of accelerate pretty quickly. He kind of abruptly retired from, announced his retirement from training, a week or so ago. And we heard he was in hospice, and so it seemed like only a matter of time. And then Saturday, his family announced that he died peacefully at home in Louisville. What this guy, let's start with what he did on the track. I mean, back in the 80s and 90s, he was as dominant as you can possibly be as a thoroughbred trainer across from coast to coast in the United States. The Jockeys Guild put out a bunch of quotes this afternoon that they gathered from some of the longtime jockeys that had worked with Wayne for a long time, including Angel Cordero, who aptly compared him to Michael Jordan and Tiger Woods of the training profession. And it's not hyperbole at all, the stuff that he did. Inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1999, 15 Triple Crown race victories, including a stretch of six straight over the span of 94 through 96 with like four different horses. And the funny thing is, I went back to double check to see how many times he actually ran a horse in the Belmont Stakes with a chance to win a Triple Crown, and it was never, believe it or not. Mm. And part of the reason why was in Charismatic, what the heck year was it? Would have been 95. He won the Derby and then finished third in the Preakness and then won the Belmont. I'm sorry. He's the only one that had a chance. He won the Derby and the Belmont. So it's amazing that he only had one shot at it, and then Charismatic finished third in the Belmont to thwart his Triple Crown bids. But another illustration of the kind of accomplishments that Wayne had, particularly in the Triple Crown races, was he essentially won a trainer career Triple Crown in 1 year. Unfortunately, Thunder Gulch lost the second leg, the Preakness, to his stablemate in 95, Timber Country. So then Thunder Gulch came back and won the Belmont and the Travers. So Wayne won all three legs of the Triple Crown that year, but with two different horses, and one of whom got beaten the Preakness. So Thunder Gulch never had a shot to win the Triple Crown. So that's just the Triple Crown stuff. You can look at Winning Colors in 1988. She was only the third filly to win the Kentucky Derby, which is kind of illustrates how far-reaching Wayne's mind came when it came, when it came to finding spots for his horses and being aggressive with them. Because in the meantime, he won the Whitney at Saratoga with another filly, Lady Secret, in 1986. Like I said, the 80s and 90s, he just crushed it. I remember writing a kind of a profile of him in the midst of this when I first started covering racing. It might have been in the early 90s or something, and the easy analogy was Godzilla, which I used in the lead of that story. I'll have to maybe dig it up and find it again. But, it was a proper comparison because he just laid waste to the whole, the whole racing landscape, especially in the Triple Crown races. But he was good in, like, all divisions, and he was very aggressive in running his horses when they were, ready to, strike while the iron is hot. Besides what he did on the racetrack, though, he very much revolutionized the profession of thoroughbred training in this country. And by that, I mean, when I already mentioned that he laid waste coast to coast, he had strings in Kentucky, California, New York, primarily, running them all at the same time with like 150, 200 horses, all of them really good horses. So he kind of developed this template of sort of the corporate trainer who, had to have very good management skills to keep track. He can only be in one place. He hired very good people, including Todd Pletcher, who went on to make it into the Hall of Fame. That is very much in evidence now with, kind of the super trainer concept where, a small number of trainers have most of the really good grade one caliber horses. And he kind of started that for good or bad. I will say also that back in the day when he was at the height of his powers, he was actually looked upon as kind of a villain because he had all the good stuff. He was very brash and outspoken. He was a sports writer's dream and always has been. He would give you so much good stuff. I can remember 1 year, I think it was leading into the Travers, and he was making a pun, like derogatory pun names for other Travers competitors' horses, including Star Standard, who was a horse in Nick Zito's barn. And Wayne was sort of like handicapping the field. And I remember him just offhand, referring to Star Standard as substandard. He was like throwing these little dig jokes and stuff. I'm like, you can never see anybody do that these days. I mean, really a revolutionary character, charismatic, like I said, a sports writer's dream. But then the last 10, 20 years, he sort of transformed into this, like the grandfather, the benevolent grandfather of racing that everybody looked up to. I can tell you, everybody who covers the Preakness from a media standpoint, whether he's got a horse in it or not, if he's over at that stakes barn at Pimlico, you stop by and just ask him some questions and get him rolling and tell him stories about the old days, and you'll be there for a while and you'll get just tremendous material, as was the case last year and this year as well. But in the meantime, so he, naturally he was never going to keep that 80s and 90s success going forever, but that doesn't mean he fell off the planet as far as being a, you know, a successful trainer. He won the Preakness last year with Seas of the Gray at the age of, would have been 88. He would have been 87 because his 88th birthday was on September 2nd, the closing day of the Saratoga meet, and I bring that up for another reason. Oh, by the way, he won the first race on that card, the closing day card at Saratoga last year, on his birthday with a 7-1 shot named Daily Grind, which I thought was pretty appropriate and pretty cool. So his accomplishments are astonishing, but his sort of contribution to the lore of the sport and being sort of an influence on so many other people, you look at the roster of big-time trainers, I already mentioned Todd Pletcher, that were assistants under Wayne and went on to have great careers. You know, people like Kieran McLaughlin and Dallas Stewart and George Weaver. So really sort of turned into the patriarch of the sport in the last 20 years or so after being sort of this, you know, monster gobbling up all the good stuff in the 80s and 90s. Really interesting character. His loss will be felt throughout the entire sport, and you'll see, I guarantee, I haven't checked in with these guys yet, but I guarantee Naira's going to have some, they'll probably have some sort of tribute during the 4th of July festival this week, and they'll probably do something for him during the meet as well, and it'll be richly deserved for sure.
Do you think somewhere down the road they'll name a stakes race after him at Saratoga?
There actually already is one at Santa Anita, I think, and I believe it's a grade one on the dirt. It's called the Lucas Classic, I'm pretty sure. I think there's a grade one out at Santa Anita, so that ship has already sailed. They'll have to come up with some other other material, but they will, and it'll be, like I said, very much deserved.
That he worked as a trainer up almost until his passing, what does that say about him?
Well, that, but also, not only was he still working as a trainer, and I got to tell you, when he had Seas of the Gray winning the Preakness last year, it was with an ownership group called MyRacehorse.com, which is this new expanded concept on the whole partnership thing where, I don't know what the fee is, it's, you could pay like $50 and get a piece of a horse, and then, like, that horse last year had over 2,000 quote-unquote owners who all had, like, this, you know, owned like two hairs on the horse's tail, essentially. So for him, you know, being a longtime traditionalist, to get involved in that sort of revolutionary concept, and you can say what you want, good or bad, about the whole race, My Racehorse. And they have so many owners that they basically have to run a lottery to like a random thing to pick who gets to go in the winner's circle. So that's not like 2,000 people, and it's more like a manageable 50 or 100 or something like that. So he was still doing it at a high level. And not only that, another symbol, I guess, of his enduring impact on the sport, or at least how this guy in his upper 80s was still doing it, and still a highly competitive person, but he was getting on the pony every morning and ponying his horses out to the track. I mean, nobody does that at 88, 89. And it was kind of a cool tribute at Churchill Downs a couple days ago. One of the outriders actually ponied Wayne's pony, whose name is Bucky, out onto the track, you know, as if he was kind of, you know, bringing him out there just to kind of show people. But it was a wonderful gesture and kind of illustrated how much respect people have for him, but also a reminder that Wayne was still kicking butt, like, you know, as much to the extent that he could at his age. But he's still getting on the pony every morning, for crying out loud.
Yeah. And you mentioned he seemed like the villain back in the day, but do you think Bob Baffert took over that role?
In two ways, yeah. He did in becoming the dominant force on the Triple Crown Trail, but also being the brash, outspoken, you know, person, the face of the sport, and, you know, the love-to-hate sort of thing going on there. And again, a media person's dream, just great quotes and, you know, very willing interview and gave you good stuff. But yeah, he inherited Wayne's role in two different ways, one being success in the Triple Crown races and then also sort of being the bad guy. And that, a lot of that was more linked to like the drug overages and the kind of the controversies that Baffert had along those lines. Wayne, I don't know if he had any history with that. It escapes me. He didn't have anything like that in last 20 years or something, where he sort of was considered dirty or anything like that from a drug standpoint. But that was a smooth transition from Wayne being this big juggernaut, brash bad guy, to Baffert sort of assuming that role. That's a good observation on your part.
And not bad for a guy who's really not much of a horse racing aficionado.
Well, that shows you the magnitude, though, too. Yeah. Again, back to a lot of my original points. If you are familiar with that, it shows you how much guys like that have crossed into the mainstream, and it's because of their accomplishments. The Triple Crown gets probably an inordinate amount of attention, but that's what people identify with if they don't follow the sport, so it's natural.
And as you mentioned, he seems like D. Wayne Lucas was a guy, great guy to interview. Is there any memorable quote that sticks out to you that he gave you?
Oh boy, they all were, and which makes it tough to pinpoint one. I'll have to go back, because I actually took video of him walking into the winner's circle after Daily Grind won the opening race of the closing day card at Saratoga last year. People were just like spur of the moment, whoever was down in there just started singing happy birthday to him. And I'm sure he had some good quotes again about how competitive he still is, and that fire will never burn out. When we talked to him after Daily Ground, right, and this was not like a big stakes race or anything like that, but I mean, the fire never stopped burning in him from a competitive standpoint.
Yeah. Also, last Saturday was also another sad news coming out of the horse racing when two-time Whitney winner commentator died at the age of 24. What do you remember about commentator?
A couple things I remember about him, and from a record standpoint, for him to win the Whitney in 2005 and 2008 as a New York bred, no less. There's only like two other horses that have won it twice, and the first running of the Whitney was like 1930 something. Kelso and Discovery were the other two. They both won it three times. Kelso won it 3 years in a row, for crying out loud. But I remember commentator, it was just the pride of the New York bred program. I also remember they had like some sort of commemorative day for him. I don't know if he was racing or what the deal was, but they brought like a huge carrot cake with frosting on it into the winner's circle for him. He took a bite out of it. Remember that, sort of, which is kind of a fun thing. He was trained by Nick Zito and just a really fun horse. The other thing I remember about him was visiting him at old friends at Cabin Creek, which is where he was euthanized, he was euthanized at the hospital, but that's where he was staying for, when did they got him there in 2016, I think it was. And he was a fan favorite, just being a two-time Whitney winner. And going there and being warned, don't try to pet him because he'll bite your hand off, even at the advanced age of 20, whatever. So you had to be careful around him. Still having your competitive juices going at an old, advanced age, that was him, just like Wayne Lucas.
Yeah. So as we mentioned, a July 4th festival at Saratoga starts on Thursday. So what can we expect from the 4 days of racing from Thursday to Sunday, and who are some of the top horses that you're looking forward to seeing?
We've got 10 stakes races. Six of them are graded. Some of them racing fans are very familiar with, including the Suburban, which is on Friday. Friday is really the big day from a stakes standpoint. It's interesting that they moved up the Sanford and the Schuylerville. Those are the two traditional Saratoga stakes for graded stakes for 2-year-olds on the dirt, which is usually opening weekend of the Saratoga meet. I think the philosophy there was to spread out the three legs of, they have another set in the middle of the meet, and then you have the hopeful and the spinaway on closing weekend. Just restricted to the 2-year-olds. So that was kind of interesting, and they might be trying to spread that program out a little bit. So we will see a lot of 2-year-old races, which this is kind of the time of year when they start to get some racing experience. There's unraced horses running in the Schuylerville. So it'll be kind of interesting to get kind of that first eyeball on the juveniles. Two horses that really jump off the page for me are Zulu Kingdom in the Grade 3 Manila on Friday, and nitrogen in the grade one Belmont Oaks for three-year-old fillies on the turf on Saturday. These two jump out. They're both three-year-olds. They both run on the grass. Zulu Kingdom is 5-for-6 in his career. His only loss was a seventh-place finish in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf last year. And I talked to trainer Chad Brown this morning about him a little bit, and he said he's hoping he has sort of a Carl Spackler-like campaign this year. Like I said, he'd be undefeated if not for that seventh in the Breeders' Cup when he had a really bad trip. So he's running in the Manila on Friday, Zulu Kingdom. Then Nitrogen, our old buddy Nitrogen, we remember from having run in the Wonder Again during the Belmont Stakes Racing Festival in June on a day when the race was rained off the turf. And trainer Mark Cassie said, screw it, we're running anyway, even though she's been exclusively a turf horse since the beginning of her career way back in August of last year. And she wound up, and there was a lot of scratches, so she was only running against two other horses, but she won by 17 lengths.
Wow.
On the main track, sloppy. And he kind of said, I don't know, maybe we should run around the dirt again. But he's not doing that quite yet. He's going to run her in this grade one Belmont Oaks on Saturday. So it'll be interesting. She's 4-for-4 in 2025 and just having, like, one of the best seasons by a three-year-old filly in North America this year, despite the fact that she's running on the turf, which doesn't get, you know, kind of the same attention as races like the Alabama and the Kentucky Oaks on the dirt. So I'm looking forward to those two. The Suburban is kind of interesting because Locked is in there. He won the Santa Anita Handicap Grade 1. He's coming off a fourth-place finish to Fierceness, last year's Travers winner in the Ali Sheba on Kentucky Derby weekend. Got a couple other interesting names in there. I mean, Locked is going to be a pretty big favorite. That as of Tuesday afternoon, the line isn't out yet, but he'll be a very big favorite. But you got Honor Marie, ran the Derby, the Belmont, and Travers last year. You know, kind of finished out of the money in all of them, but that's a horse that people will recognize. And then another one, Antiquarian, who was fifth in the Belmont last year, coming off a second to 2024 Kentucky Derby winner Mystic Dan in a race at Churchill Downs. So there's a couple in there that will be interesting names, but Locked will be, you know, the primary favorite. And then the other one that kind of jumps out is the Belmont Derby, which is the only other grade one. The Belmont Derby, the Belmont Oaks, which are three-year-old turf races, the only two grade ones during the week. And the Belmont Derby drew two horses that ran in the Kentucky Derby, including Final Gambit, who was fourth in the Derby, and Flying Mohawk, co-owned by our old friend Jason Worth, was 18th in the Derby. And these horses ran on the dirt in the Derby at a distance of ground, and now they're coming back to the turf. So those two names kind of jumped out at me, like, what's the thinking there of, like, going back? Because they were kind of like turf or synthetic runners before they kind of got Derby fever and tried that, and it didn't work out. So that's kind of what we're looking at. Besides the Belmont Oaks on Saturday, we also have the Kelso on the turf and the Sanford, which, as I already mentioned, is the two-year-old graded stakes on the dirt for two-year-olds.
Yeah. Well, part of the reason behind the New York Racing Association moving the July 4th week from Aqueduct to Saratoga is to get attendance and handle bumps. Will fans show up, and should this be considered a dry run for moving the July 4th racing to the spa permanently?
My best guess as far as the fans showing up is that Friday will be the best day. I'm not expecting a lot of people on Thursday. I think just because of the 4th of July weekend coinciding with it and 4th of July actually being on a Friday, I think people will kind of like show up on Friday. Plus, it's by far the best day in terms of stakes appeal. They'll show up on Friday and then just go find some fireworks somewhere afterwards in Saratoga Lake or wherever they're having them up there. And then I'm not expecting a lot on Saturday and Sunday as far as attendance wise. They don't even have a stakes race on Sunday. I'm pretty sure it's going to be a ghost town on Sunday. But either way, it still will be better for Naira to run to, you know, what are considered smallish crowds in Saratoga than running at minuscule crowds at Aqueduct. You know, you get to put Saratoga on display. an extra time, you know, extra 4 days. I just think that people have a lot of traditional plans on 4th of July weekend, and they'll be, you know, sticking to those instead of going to the track. In fact, when I was talking to Chad Brown this morning, he's from Mechanicville. He's got tons of family and friends still in this area. And he told me that, yeah, I don't think there's going to be a lot of people here because, you know, my people are telling me, hey, I'll see you on the 12th, meaning the first Saturday of the summer meet. So, I mean, if his people aren't showing up, I'm not sure who is. There's degenerates and diehards out there that'll love it, and they'll just can't get enough of Saratoga. So it's not going to be like a disaster or anything. And again, like I already said, it's going to be way better than at Aqueduct. As far as making it a permanent thing, I mean, I got to believe they're going to have it there again next year. I haven't looked at the calendar. One of the reasons that made it easier for them to decide to bring it up here was that Labor Day, September 1st, is the earliest it could possibly happen on the calendar. And then when they make the summer meet schedule, they work backwards from there to determine what opening date will be, which is July 10th, which is as early as it can be. And because the 4th of July fell the way it did, it didn't make sense. Well, it made sense to bring everybody up here a little early because then you only have 3 days off between Sunday, which is the last day of the 4th of July festival, and Thursday, the 10th, which is the start of the summer meet. So it kind of like coalesced from a calendar standpoint. Again, without having looked at next year's calendar to see if it'll fit very well, I got to think they're going to use the same mentality of why run it Aqueduct, even if there's like 5 or 6 days between 4th of July and the start of the meet, when we can get better, you know, way better numbers up at Saratoga. As far as it being permanent, I mean, they will be looking at the numbers very closely this year, and if they bring it back again next year, because Belmont's not going to be ready to run, you know, 4th of July next year. They'll look at the numbers. I don't think it's going to be a permanent thing only because, and I've said this many times, you know, NYRA got a $455 million loan from the state of New York to rebuild Belmont Park. You know, is the state going to get pissed at them if, you know, suddenly they're moving dates up here instead of using them at their brand new spanking beautiful facility that, you know, the New York State went out of their way to make sure they could make it happen? So I think there might be a little pressure from that direction to keep it down there. But, you know, and again, I don't think they're going to hit it out of the ballpark from a number standpoint anyway. So I don't think it's going to – I'll believe it when I see it if it's a permanent thing. Plus, they're tampering with tradition. There's a lot of people that do not want the 40 days of the Saratoga meet expanded in any way. If it ever was, this would be a logical way to do it. But I tell you, I've only been through the first 5 days of 49, and if they make 44 permanent, you know, it's just going to kind of dilute the Saratoga meet that much more, which is going to, you know, anger people. You know, the trade-off is that if they make more money up here than they would down at Belmont, then from bottom line standpoint, it makes sense. But again, I just think they're putting so much money and effort and time into making Belmont Park this beautiful, you know, palace of racing, that to not use it for four extra days, you know, it's almost like a slap in the face to New York State a little bit. So from that standpoint, I'm thinking it won't be a permanent thing, but it doesn't mean they're not thinking about it.
Yeah. And of course, we should mention that you had it basically predicted, and it came true, that the 2026 Belmont Stakes will be back up at Saratoga. So that wasn't a shock.
Not at all. I wrote that in February. And they just announced it last month officially. That was a no-brainer. And again, it goes back to the fact that, you know, when they reopen that thing, they want it to be 100% what it's supposed to look like. And if they rent, they, for all practical purposes, they could run the Belmont Stakes at Belmont Park next year because it'll be ready enough for the racing part of it, at least, to be okay. But if, you know, all the bells and whistles are not finalized in the stands and with the concessions and all the other stuff, they don't want people's first impression of their beautiful new palace to be you know, an incomplete one. So, so that makes sense. And, so yeah, well, yeah, they made it official, but you could kind of sniff out the fact that they were going to be back here in 26 without much difficulty.
Yeah. Before we started taping this segment, Mike, NIRA announced the Saratoga Premium giveaway items. What stands out to you of those items?
Oh, let me get this in front of me. Hang on a sec. I got it up on my laptop.
Well, to me, I mean, the Hawaiian shirt, but unfortunately, they're all offering just two sizes, medium and extra large. I like to wear double XL, so I'm not happy about that.
Well, my point about the Hawaiian shirt is they sneakily mention in the middle of the description of it that it's actually a T-shirt. It's not a button-up shirt, which, of course, that's the cheap way to do it, I guess. I believe it says, you know, when they say Hawaiian shirt, you picture like a short sleeve button up.
Yeah. Jimmy Buffett,
pineapples and toucans and stuff on it, which is probably what it's going to be. We don't have photos of these things. The only thing we have photo of so far is the sunglasses. But yeah, right in the middle, it says the T-shirt will be available in two sizes. So it's basically another T-shirt with, you know, some toucans on it or something, presumably. There's the blanket. That's an old standby that people use for picnics or, you know, they don't need it to stay warm, that's for sure. A pennant, that's a new one by me. Seems kind of old school. Tote bag, you know, I still have like probably six of those back in some closet somewhere from various years. The quarter zip sweatshirt, I'll be interested to see what that looks like. You know, what kind of quality we're talking about, because, you know, they're giving this stuff away. So it's like, you know, like the Hawaiian shirt thing. I'm not a clothier, but sure, it's a lot more expensive to do a button up over a T-shirt.
Yeah.
What else they got here? Well, they have a summer tour T-shirt that sounds kind of cool, which is like a concert tour. And it's got the stake schedule on the back and it's got some sort of emblem on the front. That might be kind of fun. And then the sunglasses and looks like that's it. So the sunglasses would be the first one, and that's the during the 4th of July festival, as a matter of fact. And they, you know, it says limited to the first 15,000. You know, they probably threw that bone out there to the fans. Just that's on Friday, July 4th, by the way. You know, they're probably doing everything they can to at least make that Friday a pretty big crowd, which is going to easily be by far the biggest of the 4 days. Sunday it'll be interesting see how many people are rattling around in there.
Yeah. Well, Mike, we begin another year of talking Saratoga Racetrack. We'll do this again next week.
I guess we will, won't we? We're here. I mentioned those 2-year-old races. This is like pre-kindergarten for them because usually they don't crank them up until a week later, and so it's pre-kindergarten for everybody. NIRA calls it, they're characterizing it as a prelude to the summer meet. In a lot of ways, it really is, especially since there's only a 3-day gap between the 4th of July and the summer meet. So racing fans will see some things that are happening that'll, you know, kind of generate some momentum straight into the summer meet. We'll be up there.
You can follow Mike on X at Mike_McAdam, and of course on Facebook and our Daily Gazette Sports X page. That's at D Gazette Sports. And looking forward to it, Mike. It should be another fun season.
Yep, here we go.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ken.
All right, that's Mike McAdam. We'll be back to wrap up the podcast and have the latest winner in the Daily Gazette's auto racing contest in just a moment.
Explore the benefits of subscribing to the Daily Gazette, like our convenient e-edition app, personalized newsletters, and unique reader rewards when you join. Start your membership today. Offers redeemable at www.dailygazette.com.
Hi, this is Colin Stevens of the 2014 National Championship Union College men's hockey team. You're listening to the Parting Shots podcast with Daily Gazette sports editor Ken Schott.
Back to wrap up the podcast. The Week 19 winner in the Daily Gazette's auto racing contest was Jeffrey Thayer of Schenectady with 35 points. Jeffrey wins a $50 gift card. Congratulations, Jeffrey. The VIP winner was Dwayne Leach of All Seasons Equipment with 5 points. Must have been a bad week for us VIPs. I'll announce the auto racing contest winner's name, and that winner's name will appear in Saturday's Daily Gazette. To play, go to dailygazette.com and click on the auto racing contest banner. Just because COVID-19 mandates are easing, that does not mean you should relax. Be vigilant. If you have not gotten vaccinated or received a booster shot, please do so. Do it for yourself, do it for your family, and do it for your friends. And a friendly reminder, vaccines do not cause autism. Don't forget to download the Daily Gazette app and sign up for our e-edition so you never miss a headline. Subscribe today at www.dailygazette.com. We have a lot of great specials going on. When credibility matters, trust the Daily Gazette. On the latest edition of the Stan and Shen Show, Stan Hootie and Shenandoah Briere have Scotia's Freedom Parks Board President Kathy Gatta. She stopped by with Stan and Shen to talk about this year's free concert series and some of the acts playing three times a week this summer. They talked about the music available along the Mohawk at Freedom Park, along with all the music in the air in the Electric City and beyond. Subscribe to the Stan and Shen Show on all your podcast listening platforms. That wraps up another edition of the Parting Shots podcast. I want to thank Dave Smith and Mike McAdam for coming on the show. If you have questions or comments about the podcast, email them to me at shot, that's S-C-H-O-T-T, at dailygazette.com. Follow me on X, Threads, and Blue Sky at Slapshots. The views expressed on the Parting Shots podcast are not necessarily those of the Daily Gazette Company. The Parting Shots podcast is a production of the Daily Gazette Company. I'm Daily Gazette sports editor Ken Schott. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time. From the Parting Shots podcast studio in Schenectady, New York, good day, good sports, and have a great July 4th weekend.